Welcome to Majority Rights Radio, the bleeding edge of the radical right where high technology meets high culture, as you're aware. All right, time to indict the traitors within the C4L.
That's the
I
Campaign
suppose.
for Liberty.
Right. Now, I'm on their mailing list, and they have been sending me mail because I collected signatures for Ron Paul at one point. But I regret very much, and had occasion to regret when you posted this, that I, in fact, have been throwing away their emails and paying no attention to them.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, mainly because of the fact that the Rasmussen poll, which Rasmussen is one of the more accurate pollers out there from their track record, has
They polled
found.
likely voters, right? And not.
Yeah, they
Right.
polled likely voters, and they found that Ron Paul's running basically neck and neck with Obama for the 2012 election. In fact, Ron Paul is ahead of the field in the Republicans.
Right. Well, he did very well in that straw poll the Republicans took a while back.
Well, the straw poll was mainly for the Republican Party apparatchiks. And yes, he did do exceptionally well there, primarily because his base is very mobilized and they were able to, over the last couple of years, get organized well enough to make inroads in the conventional apparatus of the Republican Party. So
Interesting that you said neck and neck, too, because necks seem to be relevant to the discussion. But let's keep going. So you say, let's indict the traitors within the Campaign for Liberty. The Campaign for Liberty is sort of the follow-on organization to the Ron Paul presidential campaign, but it's not to be identified completely with Ron Paul. Is that correct?
that's right. It's not endorsing any specific candidates. It's endorsing a general ideal of liberty and the promotion of education. So I believe it's a 501c3 organization, so they can't do specific endorsements.
But the problem with their conception of liberty is that it includes genocidal suicide, right?
Well, in the present circumstances, there's a significant contingent within the Campaign for Liberty that I would just simply call them traitors. And that contingent is based primarily upon the Austrian school of economics, von Mises, etc., that Ron Paul has himself bought into. And he's having a great deal of difficulty dealing with certain issues having to do with national sovereignty because of that. National sovereignty, of course, is the issue around which the term traitor has meaning, at least within the conventional vernacular.
Okay. You're building this in a very clear way so far. Okay, so traitor, that's a term which we use when we're talking about national sovereignty,
Right.
and they have taken a position which involves betraying national sovereignty, but what is that position?
Well, it's in the abstract, it's not so much betraying as denying its substance, denying that it has relevance except in what they call collectivism. They pay lip service to something that goes by the name of natural law. And its corollary, which is individual sovereignty. Basically, the idea is that in a state of nature, we don't have these governments, etc. We are all individuals and operate as individuals when free. And therefore, the idea of national boundaries that you control is anathema, because really what you have are a bunch of individuals with their own private land holdings. And it is up to the individuals holding those private lands to invoke their property rights and enforce those property rights under the jurisdiction that rules over that territory.
But where do property rights arise if we're in a state of nature?
Well, that's where the sophistry begins. That's really the foundation of the deception of the Austrian school. They will, when you press them on this, of course, back down and start saying all kinds of things in a way that is difficult to actually pin down. You can't actually get, for example, a very clear understanding of what they mean by a homestead. They appeal back to John Locke's terms about mixing labor with soil and things of that nature, but we have these days a much better understanding of what the state of nature actually is. And in fact, this understanding has been around for quite a while. It's just that it's been obfuscated by economists, political economists, etc. It's really basically just look at any animal, any terrestrial vertebrate, let's say. You have males.
Vertebrate.
Yeah. Right. I'm just sort of speaking, I'm narrowing it down a little bit because we can sort
no,
of.
No, like, I thought I heard invertebrate, which was clearly wrong.
Right. No, okay, vertebrate. I'm narrowing it down just so that we can simplify the discussion a bit. Males will compete for territory. And when a male encroaches on the territory of another male in sexual species, specifically the terrestrial vertebrate species, they will fight. And sovereignty has to do with the ability, or I should say the right, in a sense, to engage in the application of force or aggression. And one of the men wins and one of them loses, usually, if they're actually in a head-to-head contest. Now, this is not to say that they can't come to some kind of accommodation and maybe even work together, cooperate, and that's all about society and how society works, civilization being one kind of society. But what I want to get to is this transition from a state of nature into an artificial society where you have laws, where you have verbal agreements, the rule of law, basically, so that people can have property rights that extend beyond their simple animal territory, which is continually under contestation by invading males. And that's where I depart from the Austrians. It's also, by the way, where the Austrians depart from a lot of the earlier libertarian thinking represented by John Locke and Thomas Paine. John Stuart Mill. There's a whole range of classical economists that, if you really look at their work, do go back to what some people call blood and soil, this sort of understanding that you have to defend your territory with your blood, and that it's that mixing of blood and soil as opposed to simple labor and soil that really establishes your right to the land. So sovereignty is the right to take aggressive action to defend your territory is where things start with true individual sovereignty.
Right.
But this is something that the Austrians deny. And the way they deny it, essentially, is by saying that there is no state in which you'll have a couple of males take off after each other and start fighting over anything in particular. This is my latest addition to the family here. It's a Lacy dog, Blue Lacy. I might have to deal with these guys just a second.
That's okay. This reminded me very much of Jim Giles. I don't know if you remember his interviews. If he's always dealing with his dogs.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the intent. They were just let out of the bedroom. Anyway,
That's okay because it humanizes you, James, to have dogs. I mean, to interject them into the interview, it makes you seem, you know, more like one of the people.
Because
you have dogs.
We certainly want to maintain that illusion, don't we?
Well, come down from the Olympian heights to the degree that you have dogs.
Okay. Well, anyway.
It was Odysseus who had that dog greet him when he got home. You never hear about the Olympian gods having dogs. You notice that?
Well, that's interesting. I suppose. Yeah, I like dogs. Dogs are great. I think that it's really a good thing to have dogs. I think people need them. But we'll talk about that later.
Well,
anyway,
I think cats are valuable, too.
Yeah, that's true. So, getting back to the individual sovereignty idea, if you allow that people really don't exist unless they are able to defend their own territory, then before people enter into a social contract, or many people in the libertarian movement now decry the idea of a social contract for various reasons. Usually they decry it when they're trying to divert the discussion in some way about these issues. So we won't talk about social contract. Let's talk about Lysander Spooner's idea that each individual must himself agree to something, not simply inherit an agreement made by others. Lysander Spooner was a sort of a radical libertarian thinker back in the 1800s. And his claim was that legitimate government arises from a mutual insurance corporation established by the individuals. And that's sort of my philosophy about the way these things arise out of nature. And in essence, what you have is, when you establish a legitimate government, is you have a bunch of individuals that have, by tooth and claw, gotten their territory. And they come into this agreement for whatever reason to establish a government or a mutual insurance company. And they each have founder's stock, which is their animal territory. When they bring that founder's stock into the establishment of this mutual insurance company, they become shareholders in a very real sense. Now, that means, as shareholders, they're entitled to dividends. The dividends that they get are derived from the profits of the mutual insurance company. None of this is outside of the realm of libertarian thinking, except in so far as the idea that most folks who abide by the Austrian school of economics really don't take it to the point of thinking that there might be such a thing as a citizen's dividend that accrues to people by virtue of the fact that they simply exist. I mean, they've actually managed to come into existence. And if you really want to have any kind of legitimacy about claiming that somebody is part of your corporation or government or contract without them explicitly agreeing to be so, you have to offer them at least something that's plausible as something they would agree to coming out of state of nature into a government. And they never do. What they always offer is the following contract. You will defend the property rights of other people based upon the agreements between those people and other people. In other words, if you're born into a society, you are bound by the agreements of the people to respect the property rights that were established before you ever existed. And they'll try to weasel out of this in various ways by saying, well, gee, that's not, ideal libertarianism. Ideal libertarianism is, more along the lines of what you're talking about. But in actual practice, that's what they're advocating, because they don't deal with our current situation at all. Our current situation is one in which we have people who are deprived of land, and they are deprived of the option of going up and challenging somebody who, say, Ted Turner owns millions of acres, and saying, look, Ted, I want to feed my kids, and I don't want to be dependent on the government to do it, so I'm going to get some land and feed them. And so, Ted says, no, you can't, because I own this million acres, and so you can't have 40 acres.
So I think then you've given us the background where we can understand the following paragraph that you wrote.
Okay.
It is on this misconception of individual sovereignty, as though it were a currently operational principle of the republic, that pseudo-libertarians campaign for, if not open borders per se, and some of them do, then for a treatment of national territory as something less than a proxy for the natural law territory of the posterity of the founders.
Right.
Okay.
So basically what I'm saying is that there's a boundary, there's a very clear boundary at which individual sovereignty ceases to be the operational principle of the republic. And sometime back during the foundation of the republic, you still had individual combat. For example, Andrew Jackson went through several duels. Aaron Burr and Hamilton dueled. Hamilton died. George Washington, when he was fighting the Revolutionary War, had to give a command to all under his authority that they cease individual combat, the officers especially, to have a more cohesive army during the fight. The fact that all these things had to be done, or were being done, at the foundation of the Republic indicates there was a remnant of this idea of individual sovereignty at play.
You see that also in Kant's discussion of dueling.
I haven't read that discussion, but I'd be interested in seeing what he said.
Yeah. But that, well, it just shows that there was a remnant at that time of
right.
thinking that there was this thing that didn't really fit into the rest of the theory of morality.
Right. And especially in the Germanic peoples, this idea of individual sovereignty through single combat is something that has very ancient roots. It's more dominant as a I guess dispute processing system, or actually the appeal of last resort in dispute processing than just about any other culture in the world. I don't think that's an accident. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we are by nature individualist. We have more genetic individualism in us, which makes us more vulnerable to people who form gangs. We tend to naturally treat people as individuals. We tend not to be naturally racist. We tend not to be naturally clannish. We tend to have those things encouraged within us by moral standards and moral systems. It doesn't just pop out of us as naturally as it does with people who are invading our territories or migrating into our territories.
Now, when you say we, you may be including in that we the people in the Campaign for Liberty who have the incorrect ideas about sovereignty, but you certainly do not include inside that we the people and the puppet masters of those people. Is that right?
Well, that's right, and I think that they're, you know, getting this breakdown between the we, us, and them. What I'm really talking about is sort of a breeding, almost a breeding program that goes on over time, where you start to wipe out the individualists. The people who are genetically prone to being individualists tend to get killed. I mean, it goes clear back to, say, you know, Moses, where he had, you know, half his people killed, the other half who didn't go along with his pronouncements.
Oh, you're not talking about our breeding program. You're talking about their breeding program.
Well, okay. I'm talking about that. This is not. Yeah, you know, the specific breeding program to get people to behave more like components of a group entity. In other
right.
words, you're getting closer to a eusocial kind of species as opposed to having individual full human beings.
Now, this is really good stuff, but we're drifting from the main thrust of explaining these posts on majority rights. So let me just read another paragraph from that. Toward that end, I propose the upcoming meeting in Des Moines to be used as an opportunity for a grand jury to indict for treason those individuals occupying positions of trust and authority within and closely associated with the Campaign for Liberty who, in the current climate, treat the invasion of U.S. territory as anything less than a war of aggression being waged by foreign nations with the aid and comfort of the traitors.
Right.
I propose that the jurors be the 12 county coordinators, or I don't know. But the point is that you wrote this piece. You were calling for a purge inside the Campaign for Liberty, and
right?
A legal purge. And but then you wrote this up and you posted it on their site, and something happened to the headline, and that led to your second post. So can you explain that?
Well, it wasn't just that event that led to my second post, but what happened was I did post this because the upcoming meeting in Des Moines is going to be an opportunity when we'll have up to 99 county coordinators arriving in Des Moines. And
you are a county coordinator?
Yes.
Okay.
And these county coordinators can, if they so choose, get together and form what amounts to a common law grand jury. It doesn't have to necessarily be common law, but there has to be some kind of legal framework within which people can have justice other than the one that is being promoted by the de facto government, which clearly is not legitimate because it has violated its primary reason for existing, which is to defend the territory.
Right. It's so you wrote this up and you posted it, and what happened?
Well, the guy who runs the Daily
Where did you post
Paul,
it?
I posted it on something called the Daily Paul, which is the primary gathering place for people involved with the Libertarian and Campaign for Liberty movement.
Right. And you've got posting rights there?
Well, yeah, I do. And at that time I did, I lost my posting rights, and I'll explain that. excuse me. The title of the post specifically talked about the Campaign for Liberty because of the fact that the Campaign for Liberty is the most likely organization to actually revive the life of the nation.
Okay.
And that being the case, if there are traitors within that organization, it's especially important to get rid of them.
Right.
And since there's this entire school of thought within the Campaign for Liberty that is against the very foundation of what people essentially agree to when they enter into a government, at least of the kind we have, where they say, okay, well, I can't just walk up to a Mexican that I see on the street, challenge him to single combat to the death, kill him, and expect not to be accused of a hate crime of murder.
Right.
So in that kind of society, we don't have individual sovereignty. We have to rely on the government, which will execute us if we kill that Mexican.
Right.
We have to rely on that government to defend our territory.
You posted this thing on the Daily Poll. Time right. to invade the traitors within the C4L. That was the headline.
Right. Right.
And that was left up there, that article. But somehow the headline was bowdlerized by an admin at somebody
right.
at that site who had authority, bowdlerized the headline to say "Time to indict the traitors," leaving out "within the C4L."
Right, and since this is a C4L site,
right,
and this is really the issue that needs to be addressed, if you want to take action that's effective.
So that made it seem as if we're calling for the indictment of someone outside the C4.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody's got their idea of who traitors are. In fact, we could all be accused of being traitors at some, unreasonable level. And there's a lot of this rhetoric around all the time. So this is just yet another,
Well, I basically suspect everyone of treason except you yourself, James, and myself. And I have my eye on you pretty closely.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Good for you. So anyway, I went in and I edited the title back to its original and posted it as a log message. The reason that I did that was because I thought that the change in title was an illegitimate edit. I did not know at the time who did that edit. I didn't really care. I just figured, well...
Is it like Wikipedia in that there are a whole lot of people who can edit and there's this trail on this? Is it like Wikipedia editing, sort of?
No, no. This is the kind of situation where who knows who might have done it. It would have been somebody who, was given authority by the owner to go around and change, on his own discretion, the titles or other things, or it might have been the owner himself. But I basically just gave the presumption that this was just somebody who came in and did something and they shouldn't have done it.
Right, and in the metadata for that article, you logged the reason for the edit as correcting for an illegitimate change in the title, correct?
That's right, that's
and
right.
And you got an email from a man named Michael Nystrom, who is
right. He's the owner of Daily Poll.
Okay.
And he said that...
Can I read the email?
Sure.
Michael Nystrom, I'm being Michael Nystrom now. What kind of voice does he have? Does he lisp? Or?
I have no idea.
Okay, all right. I'm Michael Nystrom. Funny that you should deign to think what is and is not a legitimate edit on a site that does not belong to you. The Daily Poll is my property, and therefore I decide what is legitimate or not. Go post it on your own site, where you will indeed be the decider as to what is and is not legitimate. That is not your role here. This is private, not public property. Until you understand that and demonstrate that you understand that, you are not welcome to participate in this forum. The decider reminds me of George Bush, but go on.
Well, yeah.
And to which you responded very delicately, very gently, "Oh, forgive my presumption," you mailed him, "forgive my presumption that the owner would not have so edited the title of my post." You merely wrote back, "I didn't think it was you that did it."
Well, no, what I said was, I didn't presume that it was he that did it.
Right.
In other words, I was giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And
he showed himself unworthy of that doubt, and you went ahead and posted the history of this exchange on Majority Rights under the headline... I'm waiting for you. Under what headline?
Well, under I accuse Michael Nystrom of treason.
I accuse Michael Nystrom of treason. Okay. So you've explained that. And let's see. What do you say? Could you read the first paragraph there under the headline?
I don't have it before me. Why don't you just go ahead and read it?
Michael Nystrom holds a position of trust and authority associated with the Campaign for Liberty, and he has acted to aid and comfort enemies of the posterity of the founders. I therefore accuse him of treason, and demand that a grand jury indict him for treason, henceforth to stand trial in a lawful court, to be found guilty of treason by a jury of his peers, sentenced to death, and then executed for his heinous crimes. Now, even for majority rights, and even for you, James, this is going very far indeed. And I say that with the greatest admiration and respect and gratitude, but this time, if you haven't gone too far, you've gone very close.
Well, read on, please.
Right. Okay. Michael Nystrom's position, by the same sort of network effect that has allowed Jim Robinson to dominate the new media's outlet for the Republican Party's base, Mr. Nystrom effectively dominates the Campaign for Liberty's access to the new media. Since the Campaign for Liberty is even more marginalized by the old media than is the Republican base, Mr. Nystrom's position of trust and authority arising from the network effect surrounding the Daily Paul places him in one of the most influential, albeit invisible, positions in the Campaign for Liberty, hence one of the most influential persons determining the fate of the Republic. Michael Nystrom's acts of treason. Michael Nystrom, from this position of profound trust and authority during a massive and unprecedented invasion of the sovereign territory of the United States of America, has repeatedly made common cause with the treasonous de facto federal government's deliberate malfeasance in its primary duty to call forth the militia to stop the invasion. Specific acts by Michael Nystrom include a series of articles on the Daily Paul decrying the state of Arizona's solemn duty to its citizens to defend them from invasion, that duty having devolved to it by the federal government's default, and that duty entailing the eradication of the boots on the ground of the invasion. Each of these acts constitutes a court count of indictment, and they are in the public record.
Right.
And then I go on to
describe the interaction that he and I had as something that I personally can testify to that is not in the public
record. Right. And so that is the whole ground of that's the whole post. Yeah. And so I thought perhaps we could talk about the first comment.
Because we
agreed that this was relevant. The first comment is something that I posted, and it's merely a fragment of a text, The Sayings of Aquion, written by Kai Muros, and it's that section that deals with violence.
Right.
May I read it in total?
Sure.
Okay. On violence. And this is from Revolution and How to Do It in a Modern Society by Kai Muros. On violence. The first reason for using force will be very concrete. The enemies of the party and of the people must be crushed. The second reason for using force is propaganda. We must spread fear among our enemies and increase our support by reclaiming the streets from organized crime and other enemies of ordinary people. The third reason for using force is provocation. We must provoke the enemy to make mistakes and alienate themselves even more from the people, thus creating a void which the party will exploit to strengthen its base among the masses. A revolution will always be, by necessity, a violent process. This is why it is imperative from the very beginning to get used to the idea of using whatever means will be necessary to crush our enemies. However, because of propaganda reasons, the party must use force with special caution in the early stages of the revolutionary process. The party must win the confidence of the masses longing for security in uncertain times. It cannot afford to be cast in the role of a monster by its enemies. The party must be sure that its actions are acceptable to ordinary people, at the very least on an emotional or subconscious level. It is vital that the people really do understand that the cadres of the party are fighting for them. A special case will be to punish those criminals which the more or less corrupt judicial system of our time has left unpunished. While punishing criminals, one must consider the pedagogical side of using force. I'm really not pronouncing very well today. I should try to slow up here. The punishment must be severe enough to placate the justified anger of ordinary people, as well as to paralyze organized crime with fear. Thus, the party will act as the violent incarnation of the sense of justice of the people. The punishment must not consist of spontaneous and arbitrary acts of violence. Justice shall be done only after careful consideration by local organs of people's power. If necessary, the local chapters will act as temporary people's courts. The setting up of the people's courts will be an open act of defiance toward the decaying liberal capitalist system. It will be a sign of the system losing its credibility when confronted with a strong counter-society. To retain its credibility, the system will have to use force against the people's courts. Thus, the system will get into an open conflict with the sense of justice of the people, incarnated in the people's courts. The system struggle against the people's courts will alienate the people from the system. In the end, the state will be reduced to an empty shell. So, even though Kai is coming from a somewhat different ideological background than you are, I think it should be obvious how what he's saying fits into what you've called for.
Well, yeah, he's dealing not so much with the ideology as with the strategy, tactics, and practice of implementing ideology. And his ideology may, in fact, differ from mine, but he's basically correct. That's how you would pull off a revolution, even if you were basing it on improper principles. So, yeah, he's talking about practical matters.
Right. So here's my question. Because we talked about this briefly yesterday in private conversation. So I said, you know, when you posted this, did you post this on Majority Rights, this call to indict and try Michael Nystrom for treason? Is this equivalent to an assertion by you that it is now time to set up people's courts explicitly and start operating them? Because I don't think it's quite time, and I don't think you think it's quite time either. But it's time to start talking about it openly.
Well, no, what I think it's time to do is for people who are genetically attuned to individualism, which is primarily the Germanic people that founded the United States and a great deal of Christendom, in fact. It's time for those people to really start to understand who they are, get in touch with who they are, understand what their real principles are at a genetic level, and understand how they can build on those principles to have a real morality, and therefore morale of the type that Kai Mauritius is pursuing. So I'm looking at it from the standpoint of what is it that we actually value and see as just and justice?
Right.
And then say, okay, that's our foundation. Let's set up our people's courts upon that foundation. Right now in the United States, the primary focal point of that genotype is the campaign for liberty.
Right. But Kai's point is that the system, that at the moment at which it is clear that we are actually going to do this and that we should be taken seriously, the system will have to attack us with everything in its power. What the system cannot allow is for legitimacy to start draining away from them and accruing to us.
Right. And that's one of the things that's working for us is that the folks that founded the U.S. and put into the Constitution a lot of safeguards of individual liberty were, in a very real sense, attuned to us genetically. They understood the idea of and the value of individual liberty. They hadn't clarified things to the point that they really needed to. Their philosophers were not men who would go out and challenge other men to individual combat in general to hold, let's say, moral territory. And they would not in general consciously abrogate that to allow for a government to instead defend their actual physical territory. There was a lot of failed thought in the early liberals, I'll put it that way, and or maybe incomplete thought is a better term, but I think failure is not too strong a term for a lot of it. And because of that, there were some bad things that got built into the Constitution and other aspects of society, I mean, slavery being one of them, importing people from Africa. But there was enough of a foundation there that the U.S. Constitution is a good rallying point. Folks like Thomas Jefferson realized that that really is the primary function of the Constitution, is to provide a sort of a trellis upon which can grow out of the nature of the people this love of liberty and reestablishment of legitimate government.
Okay, James, I think we've pretty much covered that topic. Now, I did want to talk to you about the anarchists, too, but I think we'll save that for another show.
Okay.
All right. So thank you very much, and I'll go produce this and get it up.
Great.